Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor at The Nation magazine, who examines the strategies of the Bush and Gore campaigns in pursuing victory in this year's protracted presidential election. Former CIA officer Philip Agee, who talks about the recent arrests in Panama of several known terrorists who were allegedly plotting to assassinate Cuban President Fidel Castro while he was attending the Ibero-American summit there. And Andres Tomas Contreras, with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, who provides an update on the ongoing campaign to evict the U.S. military from the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The New Internationalist magazine reports that electroshock technologies such as tasers, batons, stun guns, and electroshock belts worn by prisoners are now the weapon of choice among military dictators and other human rights abusers. Makers of the electroshock technology got their start in the United States during the 1970s, but 30 years later, the trade in these stun devices has gone global, with Asian powerhouses like China and Taiwan now manufacturing these weapons. Roberto, a university professor held by Zaire's security forces in the early 1990s, says his captors used an electric baton to inflict pain all over his body while leaving no visible trace of torture. Reflecting upon his experience, Roberto says shock weapons are immoral because those people who market it make it for torture. They use it to make other people suffer, quite simply to make money. In the early 1990s, China imported electric batons from England. Quickly, the Chinese government started manufacturing its own batons and began to export these weapons. The Chinese also reportedly use electroshock devices on their own dissidents, like Tibetan monk Paldin Gyatso, who spent 33 years in prison. According to human rights activists, there are currently no international agreements covering the trade of electroshock technology or limits on selling these weapons to recognized human rights abusers. Amnesty International has now launched a campaign to put pressure on the Clinton administration and the European Union to suspend the use, promotion, and trade of electroshock weapons until a study is conducted to fully evaluate the human impact of this technology. Craig Roseborough, a 27-year-old Portland, Oregon activist, is the bad boy of the animal rights movement. Over the last 3 years, Roseborough has publicized acts of sabotage by radicals involved in the Animal Liberation Front and Earth Liberation Front. He first acted as the movement's self-appointed PR guy when he sent out faxes about the 1997 ALF raid on an Oregon mink farm, which resulted in the release of hundreds of captive animals. Roseborough recently told the news magazine In These Times that he decided to become the public face of this radical movement to make sure the mainstream media understood that these are not random acts, but had a clear social and political motive. He came to the conclusion that what is going to work in this day and age is direct action in the form of economic sabotage. Sabotage by animal rights radicals made national news when the Earth Liberation Front burned down housing developments in Vail, Colorado, because it was encroaching on the habitat of the endangered lynx. Roseborough in 1999 also publicized the ELF's torching of Boise Cascade's corporate headquarters in Monmouth, Oregon. Now the FBI is going after the spinmeister. In February, federal agents raided his home, seizing his computer and filing cabinet. Before a federal grand jury, the FBI disclosed that it had bugged Roseborough's phone for the past 3 years. Yet Roseborough still objects to the labeling of radical activists as eco-terrorists. He insists that nobody has ever been hurt in these sabotage attacks. Roseborough stated that the animal rights activists have a strict code of nonviolence towards both animals and people, and declares that these types of actions are at the core of social change in this country. On Thanksgiving weekend, it was discovered that a critical cut had been made with a chainsaw into the giant redwood tree known to the world as Luna. The perpetrator made one deep and precise cut that reportedly went through almost three-quarters of the tree's trunk. While the tree is still alive and standing, Luna is extremely vulnerable to a windstorm. It is believed that from the evidence of the fresh sawdust and the accuracy of the cut, the action was committed by an experienced logger. The tree stands in the small hamlet of Stafford, California, and was named Luna by forest activists who used the light of the full moon to rig a tree-sitting platform 180 feet high in the redwood tree in October 1997. On December 10th of that same year, 23-year-old Julia Butterfly Hill climbed into the tree to take a stand against the destruction of one of the nation's last remaining old-growth forests. After 2 years in her perch, with the help of members of other forest activists, Hill negotiated an agreement with the Pacific Lumber Maxam Corporation for permanent protection of Luna and a 200-foot radius buffer zone from logging. Activists are now researching what can be done to stabilize the critically injured tree, and a criminal investigation is underway to locate the malevolent logger. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
George W. Bush pronounced himself the winner of the presidential election on November 26th, shortly after his Florida campaign co-chair and Secretary of State Katherine Harris certified the Texas governor's victory by a slim 537-vote margin. But despite calls by the Bush campaign for a Gore concession, the 2000 election is headed to the Supreme Court for a ruling on the legitimacy of a deadline extension for inclusion of manually recounted ballots mandated by Florida's highest court. Refusing to throw in the towel, Vice President Al Gore is fighting a two-front war. Battling in the courts for a tally of all votes cast in several key Florida counties and working to shore up public support for what may be a protracted legal battle. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor with The Nation magazine, who examines the strategies of the Bush and Gore campaigns as they pursue victory in this year's extraordinary presidential election.
The core Republican strategy is to suppress the counting of votes. And this is a profoundly dangerous thing. And the ironic thing here is that actually, and I don't know why no one else is saying this, Bush and Gore seem to share the same presumption, and that presumption is that if we keep counting long enough, Gore will come up with the votes to win. Otherwise, why would you want to stop counting, right? This is a fundamental thing, and I am not someone who has ever been a big fan of Al Gore. To the contrary, I think he's in many ways a dangerous man himself. But there is something separate from Gore that is at stake here, which is whether people who cast votes get to have them counted. And it's one thing to pursue this through various legal means, you know, to question whether the authority to extend a deadline is imposed or not. But when it's done across the board and when it includes, members of congressional staffs, as today's Wall Street Journal reported, going down to Miami, passing themselves off as demonstrators, and really there to intimidate the vote, the counting of votes in Miami-Dade, this is quite anti-democratic and quite profound, and this is really what I think the Bush campaign has been about over the course of the last week. I think Bush has transformed the stakes in this count from a choice between contending mediocrities to a choice between do votes count or not.
Who do you think is winning this battle for public opinion? Because certainly both Bush and Gore are doing their best to maintain support, and many Democratic leaders, you know, are publicly or behind the scenes saying, well, there comes a time when you, Al Gore, you have to throw in the towel or else you're going to bring the party down. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's complicated. I think that people have a lot of understandable anxiety. They would like this to be over. But people also really have very high ideals for the election system and want a process that's fair and don't want to spend the next 4 years having to fight over whether the president we elected is really the president or not. We want to know that it was a definitive count. I'm not sure who's winning the battle for public opinion. I think that each side brings some big deficits to this. I think that Bush is tapping into a very angry and paranoid stream of American political life, and doing so knowingly, trying to stir a politics of resentment and rage when he says, you know, the court's overreached, when he says that they're mining for votes, which is not true. They're looking for votes that were cast, but they're not mining for votes that aren't there, right? There's been a series of very high emotion statements from the Bush campaign that are designed to stir resentment and anger. Gore, on the other hand, has been so set on playing the high road that he really has given up the political battle, in a way, to Bush. The most articulate spokespeople for the Democratic Party have been scarcely visible. You haven't seen a Ted Kennedy or Jesse Jackson out there organizing lots of, you know, silent marches on the Florida State Capitol or something. And that's a strategic decision on the Gore campaign's part. I'm not sure it's a wise one. I think it's because Gore thinks people will just respect him for doing the right thing, when in fact people need to have their own sense of what's at stake here ratified. And I would personally like to see a more activist response to this.
What are the precedents that are likely to be set here in this case of the 2000 election? I mean, what are some of your worst fears and highest hopes for where this brings us?
Hopes, I have very, very few hopes. There is not much good that's going to come out of this, except possibly a greater sense on the public's part of what is at stake in that basic act of voting. My greatest fear is twofold. I think, first of all, that the whole campaign on such narrow grounds between two such mediocre candidates, followed by a very angry month of recounting, will breed even greater cynicism in electoral politics and greater anger than now has existed. That's fear number one. Fear number two, which in some ways alarms me even more because it's introducing something new into the political process, is that the kind of conspiracy theories and politics of resentment, that resentment card which the Bush campaign is playing in the short run so effectively, really has the capacity to do tremendous damage to the little shreds that are left of American political discourse. I mean, in the 1950s, that politics of resentment gave us McCarthyism, and in earlier eras it gave us periods of great intolerance and polarization, and I think that we may yet reap the whirlwind over the next few years from the profoundly polarizing and resentful language that the Bush team has employed over the course of the last few days.
That was Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor with The Nation magazine. Contact The Nation at area code 212-209-5400 or visit their website at www.thenation.com. While attending the Ibero-American Summit in Panama, Cuban President Fidel Castro announced at a press conference that there was an assassination attempt being plotted against him. On November 17th, Panamanian authorities arrested 72-year-old Luis Posada Carriles, the admitted mastermind behind a series of bombings in Havana in 1997 that killed an Italian tourist. Also arrested were Cuban-Americans Pedro Ramon and Guillermo Novo, both members of the defunct anti-Castro terrorist group Omega 7, and a fourth person who entered Panama with a passport in the name of Manuel Diaz. Diaz had another passport identifying him as Gaspar Jimenez, a Miami resident with a long record of anti-Castro violence. Since then, two more arrests have been made, a Panamanian chauffeur named Jose Hurtado and a Cuban-born businessman and Panama City resident named Cesar Matamoros. Panamanian police on Wednesday, November 22nd, confirmed that they had found 18 pounds of plastic explosives buried in a vacant lot near the international airport close to the house of Jose Hurtado, the exile's driver. Although Cuban officials claim the four planned to shoot down Fidel Castro's plane with two surface-to-air missiles, so far none have been found. Philip Agee is a former Central Intelligence Agency officer who served in Latin America. He now works in solidarity with Cuba and spoke with your reporter from his home in Havana about the recent arrests.
Well, it's been big news here in Cuba. Two nights ago, the Cuban television showed actual video taken of these three of these people, and including Posada, as they left the hotel where he was staying, and they went a couple of doors away to a restaurant, and then came out, and he was making a telephone call from his cell phone out in front of the restaurant. And this was the day before Fidel got there. They have found in Panama, that is the police, I think it's 18 pounds of explosive, C4 and Semtex. And this was enough explosive to kill a lot of people. According to what's been put out in the press, the plan was to organize a bombing, which would take place when Fidel was at the university. And, of course, he went there, and there were hundreds of students who were in attendance and plenty of children around, and they would have killed many, many people besides Fidel if it had been, from their point of view, successful.
What about the history of Luis Posada Carriles?
Well, he is kind of in a class by himself as a world champion terrorist. His days with the CIA go back to about 1960. Then he was part of the brigade that invaded Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, although I don't think that he actually was part of the invasion force, but he was part of the operation. And then he went on to many different things. He worked with the secret police in Venezuela, and when he was in Venezuela, he planned the bombing of the Cubana airliner in 1976, very close to Barbados. He was convicted, and then the conviction was overturned, and then he was awaiting a retrial when he escaped in 1985 from Venezuela. After his escape, he went to Ilopango Air Base outside San Salvador, where he was involved in the resupply operation to the Contra counter-revolutionary movement in Nicaragua. And he has lived in El Salvador off and on, perhaps permanently, although traveling to many different Central American countries, and to Miami, apparently, since that time. So he's a shadowy figure who has become a legend in terms of international terrorism.
Some critics have charged that he's merely an aging exile that the Cuban government keeps accusing falsely of terrorism activity.
Well, the Panamanian president, Mireya Moscoso, has stated that the explosives found were directly connected with Posada Carriles and Novo and the others. It seems to me, anyway, that this Cuban version of a new attempt on Fidel's life is credible.
They're also requesting extradition to Venezuela.
Well, there are several countries that can prosecute this group. For example, Panama can prosecute them for conspiracy to terrorism. They can also prosecute them for entering the country with false documentation. El Salvador could prosecute them for using false documentation. Venezuela has certainly a strong case because the man is a fugitive from justice, as far as Venezuela is concerned. And then the country that really has the strongest case is Cuba, because Posada has admitted to being the mastermind behind the bombings here of Cuban hotels. There were more than a dozen bombings of tourist installations like hotels and restaurants during 1997. One Italian tourist was killed. Posada financed those bombings, and he also recruited the mercenaries from El Salvador and Guatemala who carried them out and who are now in prison here. One has been convicted and sentenced to death, and his case is now under automatic review and appeal. It's a process that takes quite a long time. So the Cuban case against Posada is extraordinarily strong.
What about Castro's claim that Salvadoran President Flores is harboring Luis Posada Carriles as a fugitive in El Salvador?
I saw the exchange at the summit conference live on television here in Havana. Certainly, there were strong words said on both sides by Fidel and by the Salvadoran president. But the actual fact is that for years now, the Cubans have been giving specific information about Posada Carriles to the Salvadorans and to other Central American governments. And I think they finally reached the point where they decided to take other measures, which was Fidel's press conference in which he announced this plot. It was such a way that it would put the pressure on Panama that they would have to arrest these people, which they did within an hour, I think, of his press conference, and also point out that other governments had not, like the Salvadoran government, for example, had not taken measures against Posada, even though Posada had admitted to the New York Times and on filmed interview that he had organized and financed these bombings of the hotels here in Havana, where one person was killed.
That was Philip Agee, former Central Intelligence Agency officer and author of The CIA and Cuba. On the Run is his fifth and latest book. Although out of the media spotlight in recent months, the struggle to force the U.S. Navy to end its bombing and occupation of the Puerto Rican island of Vieques continues. For more than 60 years, the U.S. military has used the island for training exercises, despite objections from the people of Vieques. Activists renewed the decades-long fight to end the exercises on the island in April 1999, after 24-year-old David Sanes, a security guard, was killed by a stray bomb. In response, hundreds of protesters occupied the bombing range, serving as human shields. After a year of occupation, federal agents forcibly removed more than 200 protesters on May 4th. Earlier this year, the Clinton administration negotiated an accord with the governor of Puerto Rico, Pedro Rosselló, which resulted in a presidential directive. Among other things, the directive called for much of the land currently occupied by the military base to be returned to civilian use, but Congress failed to ratify it. It also scheduled a controversial referendum to determine the future status of the island's military installation. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Andres Tomas Contreras, a Methodist minister and a member of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, who talks about his own civil disobedience action on the bombing range and provides an update on the ongoing campaign to evict the U.S. Navy from Vieques.
I, along with a number of other folks, decided to continue to serve as human shields, and so we went into the wild, into the bush. Well, in spite of the fact that we were there on the bombing range, the bombs did start to fall even while we were on this live fire range, and it was just absolutely unconscionable that the Navy would do that. Since that time, waves and waves of people have gone back onto the impact area to do this kind of a peaceful resistance so that the Navy would get the message that they have to leave.
Has that had any kind of impact on the Navy's exercises, do you think? I mean, are they doing less than they would be doing if you all weren't there?
Yes, we really believe that the civil disobedience campaign has had an impact. So much so that President Clinton, on November the 7th, he talked to a radio station and on Democracy Now, the program, and to Amy Goodman, he said that because the U.S. Congress had not followed the presidential directives with regard to the land transfer, that he believed, because of that, that the people of Puerto Rico and Vieques had a right to demand that the U.S. Navy stop all bombing immediately.
He is, I guess, at this point, a lame duck president. Do you have any idea what the positions are of either Al Gore or George W. Bush on this issue?
We've heard that both of the political parties say that they will uphold the presidential directives. But now we're hoping for much more than that because the people of Vieques and Puerto Rico have not been happy at all with the directives themselves. What happened also in the election on November 7th is that And people elected into office in Puerto Rico, we're talking about the mayor of Vieques, the delegate that serves in the U.S. House of Representatives from Puerto Rico, and the very governor of Puerto Rico, all of them, now the newly elected members of the government are very much against the U.S. Navy presence and the bombing, and are very much for the situation for peace in Vieques. And so given that change, there is all the more pressure on the Navy as well as any administration that comes in to comply with the will of the people and have the bombing stop immediately and forever.
So you just talked about a change in government and a number of different levels. Was that change, do you think, a direct result of their opponents or maybe the incumbents not having that strong a stand in favor of getting the Navy out of Vieques?
Absolutely right.
I know one of the pieces of the agreement was there was supposed to be a referendum by all the people of Puerto Rico, not just Vieques, to make some kind of determination or at least express their opinion about whether the Navy should get out of Vieques. Where does that stand?
Well, this referendum is a part of the presidential directive, and it is to take place 270 days either before or after, sometime in early May of the year 2001. Basically, that referendum is a choice between live firebombing forever, basically, with no end point, or inert bombing, which would then end in the year 2003 and the Navy would leave at that time. But both of those choices involve bombing, and the number one choice of the people in Vieques and in Puerto Rico is that they don't want any bombing. They want an immediate halt to the bombing, and they want the Navy to leave now permanently. So it is questionable whether the people will participate in the referendum because the choice that they mostly want is not there.
Given what you just said, then, what are people doing to try to accomplish what they see as their goal, which is to stop the bombing immediately?
With the election that took place, the people's will has been very clearly heard. November 13th, a very historic gathering took place of all of the political leadership from all the political parties in Puerto Rico. They came together, the three previous candidates for governor came together from all the parties and agreed to write a letter to President Clinton asking him to halt the bombing before he leaves office. And there's a good possibility that that may in fact happen.
That was Andres Tomas Contreras with the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Contact the fellowship at area code 845-358-4601. Or visit their website at www.forusa.org. Additional information can be found at www.viequeslibre.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.